Morning, everybody. This early hour, everybody freshly woken up, and time for IBOR.
Yes.
Rihanna.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. We have two agenda papers to discuss with you today. The first one is agenda paper 14A, which includes the comments we've received back on the proposals we had in the exposure draft on the phase one amendment, as well as the specific questions we've asked in that exposure draft. And agenda paper 14B sets out the comments we've received on matters that were not specifically addressed in the exposure draft, but were consistently raised by our respondents to say, to flag these matters as something for the board to consider, either as part of phase one when we finalize the amendment, or then as part of phase two if it cannot be done in phase one. Now, the way we'll tee up the papers today is we're going to tee them up together because there's a bit of an overlap between them. So I'll hand over to Lira and Fernando to tee up the papers together, and thereafter we'll hand it over to you for discussion. There's no specific question that we are asking, and you're not being asked to make a decision today, but we have included a question in agenda paper 14B just to say that if there's any questions or observations you have on any of these matters, or you want us to do more analysis on any of these before we come back for the August meeting, then, you know, that will be useful for us to know. After we've had the discussion, I'll just give you a bit of an update on the plans for the August meeting and the matters that we'll likely bring back to you for discussion at that meeting. So I think, Lira.
Yes. Thank you. So as Rihanna pointed out, agenda paper 14A provides a summary of the feedback from comment letters on the proposals included in the exposure draft. As a reminder, the exposure draft addressed only the issues affecting financial reporting in the period before the replacement of interest rate benchmark with an alternative interest rate, or the so-called pre-replacement issues. More specifically, only the following hedge accounting requirements in IFRS 9 and IAS 39 were amended, and those are the highly probable requirement, the prospective assessments, and the separately identifiable risk components. Overall, respondents welcomed the board's approach to address the pre-replacement issues and showed strong support for the amendments proposed in the exposure draft. Nonetheless, they suggested the board to extend the scope of the proposed exceptions beyond hedges of interest rate risk to also include, for example, hedges of foreign currency risk, and propose exceptions for the effects of the reform on hedge accounting relationships in the context of macro hedge accounting. They also suggested the board reduce the disclosure requirements because the requirements as proposed in the exposure draft were considered burdensome. And they also suggested the board clarify the interaction between its proposal to not allow reinstate hedge accounting relationships that were discontinued in prior periods with the proposal that the amendments apply retrospectively. Finally, most respondents also suggested that the board address replacement issues that might affect financial reporting, so issues that might affect financial reporting when the interest rate benchmark is replaced. And they suggested that the board address these issues as soon as possible and in parallel with finalizing the amendments proposed in the exposure draft. I'll hand over to Fernando for teeing up agenda paper 14B.
Good morning, everyone. So as Rihanna said, agenda paper 14B summarizes the feedback from comment letters on issues that have not been included in the exposure draft. More specifically, these issues are IAS 39 retrospective assessment, modification versus derecognition of financial instruments, and changes to hedge documentation. This paper does not include any staff analysis or recommendations to the board, and therefore we are not asking the board to make any decisions based on this paper. So regarding IAS 39 retrospective assessment, most respondents noted that for DED to achieve its objective of not disrupting hedge accounting due to the uncertainty of the reform. The uncertainty should be excluded for the purpose of the retrospective assessment, similar to other exceptions provided in the ED. These respondents agreed that ineffectiveness should continue to be measured and recognized in accordance with IFRS standards, irrespective of whether ineffectiveness arises from the IBOR reform or any other reason. These respondents requested the board to consider whether entities could continue hedge accounting when the hedge is temporarily outside of the range of 80 to 125%, solely due to uncertainties arising from the reform. Respondents also requested the board to consider the interaction of the reform and the accounting requirements for modification and the recognition of financial instruments. Respondents noted that the accounting for contractual amendments as the recognition event could have some knock-on effects on other areas, such as impairment of financial assets and hedge accounting. Finally, many respondents requested the boards to consider whether entities could continue hedge accounting after making changes to hedge documentation that are related to the reform. For example, this could include situations when, as a result of the reform, entities update the hedged risk, the hedging instrument, or the hedged item in the hedge documentation, or identify new sources of hedging effectiveness that was not present at the inception of the relationship. So with that, I would like to turn over to the board for any comments or questions on both papers.
A couple of comments and observations, and partly with a sort of perspective of trying to help you guys in terms of the tight timeline for papers for August. On the comments that we got back, maybe just to comment on a few where I think the fair points were raised that I think we should look at. I think the comments on disclosure were probably fair. And I think that probably what we need to do there is to take a step back and think about what we're really trying to achieve with the disclosure requirements. Mm-hmm. I think perhaps we almost had a flavour that somehow you were going to understand your exposure to IBOR uncertainty as a result of the disclosure, and that's never going to be the case because it only applies where you're applying hedge accounting, and the exposure to IBOR reform is far broader than that, particularly for the banks. So I think we need to take a step back, and we probably could make the disclosures a bit easier to apply and a bit less burdensome, perhaps thinking about whether some sort of focus on the notional amounts of the hedges affected, for example, might be, you know, something more along those lines. But starting with an objective and then sort of working from there, I think that would be fair. Some of the comments on the retrospective interaction, given that we were very much focused on the making sure that it was clear what to do from a prospective perspective. I have some sympathy on this, but not total sympathy on this, I guess. I think it's fair to say that if basically we're undermining the relief by saying, you know, don't worry about this uncertainty for the prospective assessments, but too bad if you bust the 81-25, it's all the game's over anyway, we've sort of achieved nothing, so I get that. But on the other hand, I don't think we can say that because 9 doesn't have an official retrospective test that suddenly we can get rid of that in 39. Even for the subset population. If people really love 9, they can move to 9. But also, I don't think, and I don't think starting to think about sort of incremental effects or moving the 81-25 is really a starter as well. But perhaps what we could think of would be to try and make it more clearly aligned between how you think about prospective and retrospective. So, for example, thinking about doing the 81-25 assessment, taking the same assumptions about IBOR that we've provided for the relief for prospective, so assuming that there's no IBOR change to the cash flows, mm-hmm. For the 81-25 test, but still doing the measurement completely, so you could stay in hedge accounting, but your actual ineffectiveness might be bigger than 81-25, something like that, maybe is more in the spirit of what we intended. And then another couple of small comments. On paragraph 17, people talked about the fact that the scope might have been too narrow. And I think certainly that they've got a case for things like foreign currency hedges, which are really a combination of interest rate risk and foreign currency hedging. So we should look at that. But I think some people talk about extending the scope of the proposed amendments to apply to all hedge accounting relationships affected by the reform or directly affected by the reform. I think all hedge accounting relationships are affected by this reform because it affects the values and the measurement. So we need to be very careful not to go overboard with that rewording because it might be read far more broadly than what we intend. And then the last comment I was going to make is on paragraph 41. So some people have said they would like us to provide an exception from the requirement for reliable measurement, which we said was sort of untouchable in the exposure draft. In my view, that is still untouchable, because if you don't have reliable measurement, I don't know how we can be comfortable with the measurement being used to apply hedge accounting. So for me, that's a sort of no-go area.
Mm-hmm. Just picking up on a couple of those. I'd also be sympathetic to be having a look at the retrospective test under 39 to see what we could do there. But like Sue, I'm not really sympathetic to tweaking the range or trying to work out what's driving moving outside of the range. I just don't think they're practical. But if we can look at other potential measures there. And then on disclosures, I think our disclosure requirements were put together, or the proposed ones, on the basis that these would be relatively inexpensive for preparers to do, and if we've learnt new information here, it probably is worth rethinking. And for me, the objective is probably just to size how many, the extent to which the relief is being used, I think. And so think about the simplest way of doing that, and perhaps with some qualitative information around that. I think that may be a way forward to consider.
Can I ask Nick a question? Nick, you just said for the disclosure, it's how broadly the relief is being used is what you're interested mm-hmm. in.
Yep.
Sue seemed to be talking about how broad is the population of instruments affected by IBOR reform. Are you...
No, I think so.
Okay.
It wasn't.
I was saying we can't get that with a hedge accounting thing okay. because it's not a matching population.
I think we're on the same yep. page.
Okay.
Yeah.
And also on this point, I think the most relevant, I think, is this retrospective, and I would also be open to do something about the 80-125, and not to relieve the measurement. I think they should really measure ineffectiveness, but if they're out of these ranges, based on this uncertainty, I would be also happy if they can continue hedge accounting, but measure really the ineffectiveness then in the P&L. And I think it is not possible to distinguish then, okay, what is related to uncertainty, what is other, so I think we have to give a relief from, if you fall outside, you can continue hedge accounting, but measure the ineffectiveness in the P&L. For disclosure, I'm also, Sue, I think it is, we could ease that because I think the relevance of this information is limited, and I would be happy to do something. What I also found important, when many people said, okay, we should not debate now further other issues, because I think which might become to re-exposure, because this relief is needed, and I think that is also what we have to take into account. We have to not rush, but I think to make it on a timely basis our decision, so that we can really issue the relief and then people can use it for year end.
Can I just ask Martin, when you say you are open on the retrospective test, and you know, so if people fall outside the range, then they can continue hedge accounting as long as they book all the ineffectiveness. Do you have a preference or a strong sense of how that can be achieved? I mean, because some people say, well, just do a qualitative assessment, whereas others, like Sue mentioned, said, look at IFRS 9 and use the economic relationship kind of assessment.
Yeah, in this regard, I would use what we have in 9. So a statement, if there is not any relationship, we should not use hedge accounting. But if it is qualitative, but if you fall outside, still you have to meet the qualitative criteria, which maybe is 9. Good.
But to be clear, that's not what I'm saying.
No, I know. You mentioned it. Yes.
I mentioned it as something I wouldn't go near with a barge pole. Just to be clear.
Do you want to be clear?
So I'm
happy to try and help, but more along the lines of the consistent logic with the ED. So saying test the 8125 with the simplistic assumption that IBOR stays as it is, but then if the test if the maths falls outside 8125 when you actually do the measurement, I'm fine with that.
And I'm not sure if you can do that. You can measure the 8125 and then isolate what is then related to the IBOR reform and what is the rest. I think that is, if that is possible, I would agree to you, but I'm question if people really can do that. They can isolate, okay, what is maybe then the effectiveness based on this reform and what is other issues. And that is what I'm not sure if we can really do that. If it is really a relief, because I think to measure that is would be difficult.
Based on conversations I've had, I think it's doable. But.
Darren?
So, agreed with most of what's gone on before in terms of general on this particular topic, Sue, I think I've probably been falling into the same space as you, without necessarily having thought too hard about whether it is doable or not. So I think it's probably worth just touching side with one or two people beforehand. But I had the feedback I'd heard on it that it seemed to indicate that it was doable. I had a couple of general questions, and I just wanted to confirm. Paragraph 14C of the A paper. I'm scared I know what they mean by that, but I just wanted to check that I was properly understanding. So this is a paragraph that says that people think we should look to address this through interpretations. Were there specific ideas of what they thought could be interpreted as opposed to changed in the standard, or was it perhaps a blunter use of the interpretations process than we would normally think?
I think it was more a wider view on what could be done. I'm not sure to what extent people felt that what we are proposing is, in any case, what you should be doing, and I'm slightly concerned that that might be the case, and that's why we should go to the Interpretations Committee.
Okay. And then just generally through the paper, just picking up the sort of the favourite, whenever we do comment letter analysis, the most and et cetera, what it felt like to me for the most part in this was that there was general agreement with a lot of the things we were suggesting. Whenever we've used some in this comment letter, it seems like it's mostly people suggesting additional things, but there seems to be very little conflict of views where some people have said this and other people have said something completely different and disagreed.
Yeah.
Is that a fair takeaway?
I think it is, and I think, you know, overall, everybody agreed with what we said. Some, to use your words, just said we had to go a bit further or we need to add a bit of clarity or, you know, add some one or two items. But what we proposed, they agree with overall.
Thank you.
I agree with the discussion we've had so far about the things that we will try. I'd just like to clarify in paragraph 14 things that we're not going to do, because, as you're just saying, people couldn't resist suggesting additional things, and some of those are viable suggestions, except that we have such a tight timeline. So I just want to confirm with you there's things in here that you won't pick up because we won't get chance to see you again before we have our August meeting and see the documentation. So I wasn't sure about the objective one, so I'll come back to that one. But B, the principles, I don't think we'd be developing principles because we aren't trying to future-proof or get ready for dealing with other reforms. I think we're narrow in scope here, and I think we've always been clear about that. So I think we dismiss that one. Daryl touched on 14C. I didn't see that as a viable way forward, given our timeline. I just couldn't see how we could be doing that when we're trying to respond to the urgency of the situation. In terms of aligning with other standard setters, well, we've been consulting with others, trying to find out what they're doing and recognising that. So I suppose back to A, the objective. I don't know if you're going to spend time on an objective. These things sound easy, but they're not easy. And you could arrive as staff at a recommended objective that then the board members, some agree and some disagree. So I'm not sure that that's a good way forward, except in relation to disclosure, when I think knowing clearly what the purpose of the disclosure is, and I think Nick has mentioned that and Sue alluded to it as well. I think there it might help. And other people in the letters have talked about application guidance, which again is a very vexed question, and I don't think that we have time to be looking at that kind of support in what we're doing. Now, having an objective, the argument is that having an objective means it makes it clearer for people when they're trying to apply. So I just encourage you to think about the extent to which you want to have some sort of overarching statement without slowing it down and complicating what you're doing.
So you want to go?
I don't think I've ever seen an objective-based exception, which is what they're asking for.
Yeah. No way to go then.
I usually like very specific boundaries.
So only for disclosure then.
And then, well, I think to some extent the objective of why we are making these exceptions have been set out in the basis and saying that, you know, during the pre-replacement phase, discontinuing hedge accounting solely because of the uncertainties coming from the reform would not result in useful information, and therefore the board has made the exceptions that it's made. And I think it's also we've made it clear in some of our other staff papers that the standards are already giving you everything you need to apply it. It's not that the standards aren't clear. We're just giving you sort of an exceptional relief from applying the standards in, you know, that word. So I agree with you. I don't know that we really have another objective.
Our decision then is the extent to which we say just what you've said. Because we do standard setting when we've got an identified problem. We have an identified problem that's clearly described. So then there is an objective of our response, and you may want to stay it as simply as that. It's not going into principles for the reason Sue's saying that we don't. Yeah, there's lots of reasons why we're not going into try to do some principles. Yeah.
Gary,
thank you. Well-written papers to the staff. It's so refreshing to actually get comment letter feedback where almost everybody agrees with us, other than maybe didn't go quite as far as you could have. So it proves it can happen. I think there's some requests to extend the scope, you know, into foreign currency and stuff. My sense is I wouldn't do that at the moment. You put them into phase two, or maybe it's a phase 1B or something, but I think somebody mentioned it. The further you push this, you run the risk of re-exposure. I think it's more important to get clarity and finality on this ASAP. And, you know, phase two, you know, maybe doesn't have to go quite with the light speed that this one did, but it still can be done fairly quickly because it's still a tightly defined set of transactions that are in scope. On the retrospective, just somebody help me out, or maybe I'll direct the question to why is this is not an issue with 9, but it is in 39.
IAS 39 requires when you assess whether you've had a highly effective hedge over the period of the hedge accounting, you measure your results, so the changes in the fair value between the hedged item and the hedging instrument. And if those changes offset within a range of 80 to 125%, then it's highly effective and you continue hedge accounting.
9.
Yeah. So IFRS 9 doesn't have that range. Mm-hmm. It just says, well, you need to assess whether you still have an economic relationship that is highly effective. But it doesn't say that if you move outside a certain range, you are no longer deemed to be highly effective. And that's why.
So in concept, you know, you could be at 75% and declare it highly effective, even though you still recognize and measure, you know, whatever the ineffectiveness is.
Ish.
What's that?
Ish.
Well, you took the quantitative ranges out, and presumably
Harry Kubrick said 75% is okay. We just have to be careful.
No, it was a question as opposed to a statement. I'm testing understanding, you know. IFRS 9 is a very awesomely written document, but doesn't answer any question.
Nice try, recovery.
It's having long recover, you know. But I think the problem, I'm sympathetic to retrospective, and to say we're not doing it because that's what 39 says and 9 doesn't, I don't think that's good enough. You know, the answer is your most recent thinking says you don't need the quantitative range on hedging. And so you have older thinking that says you do, and that was consistent with the times, you know, that that particular body hedge accounting was developed. But we, for reasons that were very valid, we moved away from that as 9 was developed and issued. So I think just saying, well, it's in the old rules, we've got to stick to it, I don't think that's a winning argument. When, in fact, if you've got a, can demonstrate an economic relationship before, during, and after, and presumably your most companies are operating in the 80 to 125% range on most instruments most of the time, think we need more than just 39 says so. You know, it's just in my judgments. And I'll just leave it at that and see where we go.
Françoise.
Well, I think we have entered this project, at least my understanding, on two, with two very clear principles or guiding directions. One being that we didn't want hedge accounting to be disrupted just because, hedge accounting relationships being discontinued just because of the uncertainty, the change in the rate. And we also have said that at all times we wanted the accounts to reflect the economic reality. And in the way we go further in granting relief, I think we need to be in line with these two directions. So to be honest, I have not grasped all the variance, the detailed variations that there were between Shu and Martin. I would need more analysis to understand them. But I think, to me, these guidelines are key in reaching the right solution. And in terms of the scope, I think the scope has been exposed, and we have received comments. So I think taking into account some of those comments and modifying the scope does not lead to exposure. So I would wish to accommodate what needs to be accommodated.
Just on the perspective thing so that other people can maybe respond, but on Françoise's point that she just made on scope, I think I would agree with you, because on the foreign currency hedging in particular, I think we may well have actually intended that it probably would be in scope already, but the way we drafted it, I can see why somebody might have reached a different conclusion. And that's because it really is a lot about interest rate risk, even though it's about currency as well. So I think that that's a very valid thing to adjust as part of the re-deliberations. Just on the retrospective point, I think that the reason why I'm being sort of tiptoeing a little bit around what I'm saying on retrospective is that our objective, as I understand it, is to make sure that if you've got a challenge or uncertainty with your hedging relationship simply as a result of IBOR reform, we don't want that to upset hedge accounting relationships at the moment. So that's our sort of working assumption. And that sort of works relatively easily in 9, because if you've passed the prospective assessment, it's a much more judgmental economic assessment overall, and so you don't have the strict 81-25, which is what we've got this incremental challenge with IAS 39. I think for us to say don't worry about retrospective in 39 would be an inappropriate thing to do, even though we've got different thinking in 9, because the model's just a fundamentally different model, and if we take a piece of it and stick it in 39, we're going to have an odd combination. But I think we still need to try and stick to our objective, which was don't let IBOR reform itself upset you. So why would I not just say, well, you're okay if there's uncertainty about IBOR reform, don't worry about the 81-25. I think the challenge that I have, and some people allude to it a little bit in their comment letters, is that I'm not sure that IBOR reform in itself would tip somebody outside 81-25 if they had a very strong hedge between the hedging item and the hedging instrument, because the measurement uncertainty probably isn't that huge. Where it starts to be a challenge is if you already had quite a lot of other noise in your hedge because you haven't got a perfect match between your hedged item and your hedging instrument. So even if we had no IBOR reform at all, so it wasn't even an issue, that could be a hedge which is already much closer to 81-25 at the boundaries, because there's just other noise going on in there. Our challenge would be that if we had a hedge that would have already been at 79-119, and it's just nudged over by IBOR, is it really right to say that that was IBOR reform that was the problem or not, because it was all this other noise that was causing the problem? And that's why we have the challenge of trying to unpick it. So that's why my thought is to try and say, okay, if setting IBOR reform as an uncertainty is taken out of the equation the same way as in the ED, it would be okay. Then that seems a way to sort of try and separate out the effect of IBOR from the other noise in the hedge, without actually measuring them separately. So, but that's why we're not, why I'm not just so sanguine about not worrying about 81.25, because it might have already been a hedge. It could have been a hedge that would have failed anyway without IBOR reform, and we'd be creating a safe harbour for all that other noise under the sort of masquerade of IBOR reform. And so I think that's why we just have to be a little bit careful while still trying to be reasonable.
Changu.
Thank you.
Just a couple of things so that we can bring it in. I think both are critical. Gary, I fully appreciate your scope. I'm very worried also about the scope creep. I think on the Forex bit, let me clarify. What has come in is that when you do, let's say you have a foreign currency floating rate loan, and what you have done is you have hedged it back to your local currency using a single instrument, which is a cross-currency swap. So effectively, that loan is subject to, let's say, US dollar IBOR reform. So, but the way we have drafted it is that it seems that if you use a single hedging, you don't get the relief. So I think that's the bit I would say we already intended, because that hedge is nothing but a foreign currency hedge separately plus an interest rate swap hedge. So that's the scope bit I think Rihanna was talking about. We should clarify. I think would we, you be comfortable with that without going. I don't think we are saying that you, if you have a separate foreign currency hedge that you get into relief or anything like that. So it's those kind of combination hedges.
Yeah, I don't know if I'd be comfortable or not. It's, I mean, it's not intuitive to think through. But so as you go through, you know, where do you draw the line? Because you can get these foreign currency instruments where the principal is denominated in one currency, interest is denominated in another, neither one of which is in the reporting currency of the entity. I mean, so where do you draw the line? I'm just saying, and the minute you start drilling into that stuff, more and more questions and more implementation questions, let's say, even though I'm not unsympathetic to doing it, I think it's more important to finish this a month from now. So and maybe expedite phase two, but I don't think you deal with anything that challenges or gets in the way of wrapping this in 30 days.
I think that brings me back to Sue's comment about that we have to be very specific. So what we are talking about is the same relief being applied when you have a combination hedge, which is interest rate risk and foreign currency, and the only one I can think of is a cross-currency swap. So you absolutely agree. We need to be very particular. Coming to the retrospective test, I think, yes, I do agree. This is where the comments have come in. And as and Francois also pointed out, our objective was not to change the models completely. This is not the reason to change completely the models or try and import some aspects from 9 into 39 or 39 into 9. So, for example, one of the things in 39, because it brings in the retrospective, you can continuously designate and de-designate, which 9 won't let you do. So it becomes very tricky to fit all of these parts together. So I would caution against that. The other part of the retrospective test and what the relief is coming from, yes, you can certainly try and isolate and measure whether is the uncertainty blowing it. But remember, these are interest rate risk instruments, so I don't have what is called an equation where I can plug in numbers, so you'll have to do simulations. It can be done, but it's not easy. So I think, one, coming back to Sue's point, what we are trying to do is that if your hedge was going along fine, just because of IBOR reform, you shouldn't fail it. But if you had any other uncertainty in the hedge, which could have taken you out of the range, that is not being passed over. And this is where I think part of the issue comes from the clarification, or which maybe we were too subtle in BC 23, where we said that if you look at any valuation of fixed income instruments, there are two sources. One are the cash flows, the other is the discounting. So what we said is that for prospective, you assume the contractual cash flows without any change. And for discounting, you use the market curves. So if you do that on the hedged item and the hedging instrument, you are just continuing as before. And that also, very importantly, by saying you keep contractual cash flows the same and you discount using the market curves, is exactly how interest rate products are valued. Because don't forget, in the retrospective test, one of the components that goes in is the fair value of the derivative, which is under IFRS 13. So it's difficult to change that. So I think when we look at it, one analysis would be useful is to clarify how BC 23 comes in and helps you exactly to make sure that you continue as before, because you are also consistent between retrospective and prospective. And the other way is that if you can demonstrate that you can isolate this reliably and you are still okay, then go ahead, because that is a finer test. So these are two ways of thinking about how to approach the retrospective assessment, because let's not forget, one of the elements in there is an IFRS 13 number, which is a market fair value number. So these are the two ways, I think, of thinking about how do we go about the retrospective.
Just a simple comment on that retrospective application. So I'm very sympathetic with Carrie's comment. But you explained if you can provide such kind of justification, why it's not allowed to do that at the final in a standard, if our stakeholders suggested this kind of ideas. So if they accept our justification, then it's okay. But there is a kind of a risk of some kind of abusers, because of this, as this was explained, suggest. So everything is mixed in this direction. But we don't want to hurt anybody. They have to stop their hedge account because of this. We don't see any possibility of the retrospective application. That's the problem. So please come. Okay.
Mary?
I'm going to go back to something Gary said, which is about, nice to see a summary of comment letters that's almost overwhelming support for what we're doing. And I say that because I think it's, apart from the moment of gratification, I think it reinforces the message of we have the right step for phase one. Let's get it wrapped up and done, rather than trying to make it, polish it up, make it even better, do tweaks at the margins. It's not that I think we should explore some of the things that people are talking about, but let's do it in the context of trying to get finalized and get something out that answers the majority of the questions for phase one for the majority of the people, rather than taking a lot more time to get only incremental improvements. I think it's also quite important. I'm going to take that strong support for what we were doing as strong support for the fact that there needs to be standard setting to provide this relief, rather than the suggestion that there's some things that you can do interpretively within the existing standards and requirements. Then in terms of direction that we take, I think, or issues that we look at, like many others who spoke before, I think it's that I also felt reading the summaries that retrospective and looking at how retrospective for IS-39 is something that in terms of finalizing phase one, I would like the staff to analyze the concerns and comments and see if there's something we can do in the context of this project. And I think the context of this project does not involve fundamentally changing some of the package that is IS-39 versus the package that is I4S9. And also looking at disclosures, and I think Sue said it about standing back and saying, what were we trying to accomplish, and is there a better way to accomplish it than what we heard is high cost and not necessarily all the information that somebody is looking for. I think there does have to be disclosure. It isn't we can leave that piece behind. Another thing that I hadn't heard people mention before is I saw several references to macro hedging and the interaction of the proposals with the macro hedging guidance. I want to ask the staff to think about whether there's any clarification we can give about how we were thinking of the interaction, or maybe we should have, in retrospect, spelled out a bit more about how that worked. But I don't think it's creating something new or standalone with respect to macro. It's just, articulating what the application is. One other point, and this goes maybe a bit to this foreign currency interest rate, interaction that Sue and Kumar were speaking about, but I think it also goes to the documentation question, where people are saying, we're starting to see the changes in documentation happen as we start to get closer to jurisdictions working out how the reform happens. There might be things that we say we have to prioritize, And, you know, Gary made a passing reference to phase 1B. And, you know, maybe this is getting more into what Fernando's going to talk about in terms of the you know, which Fernando teed up about the next phase. It, you know, if we think there are a couple things that you'd put into that bucket, then maybe we do have to think about phasing it more rather than trying to slow down phase 1 to work it into that or telling people to, you know, wait until they're right on the margin in terms of phase 2. But I'd rather do it that way. It isn't pretty, but then put phase one at risk. So that's kind of a project management reaction. So I come back to retrospective disclosure and you know, the interaction with macro hedging as the things that kind of stand out for me in this package. But I think we need to do standard setting. I think we need to be clear that we're viewing it as creating an exception rather than this is just application of how you deal with the hedge guidance and be clear about what our scope is.
Daryl. So I also wanted to ask about the macro hedging, and maybe there's more of a question for staff than just to in terms of thinking of the macro hedging questions we've got as more of a clarification than anything else, is that where staff have landed on this one?
I think the way we've been thinking about it and the way some of the comments have been phrased is that it is really just a clarification of how the exceptions and the relief we've given in the exposure draft would apply to a macro hedge.
It's not a change in anything we're thinking about more of.
It is very tricky, and then I think that's why, you know, maybe it needs a bit of careful thinking. But the questions that were asked was, one, it was around the, if you've got a portfolio fair value hedge, how would you apply the separately identifiable criteria to the hedge, given that there might be frequent de-designations and redesignations, and every redesignation might be seen as the inception of a new hedge, and so you would have to apply it there. So the question is, how, if any, did we mean for that separately identifiable, the relief from only applying it at inception, how would that apply to those kind of situations?
Ken Chow.
Yes. Just a very quick two comments. First, with regard to the scope, including whether we needed to adjust macro hedging some. And I think at phase one, the objective, we try to believe, you know, quickly to provide some relief for some companies. So I think the scope should be narrow and specific, and we can quickly fix those issues. So I prefer, you know, if we're going to open the scope and maybe a little bit broad, we should be very careful with that. I think during the joint meeting with FSB, if we look at there is also another, you know, other contracts such as loan contract, the lease contracts, so it will be very broad. So I would like to fix those issues as soon as possible and keep the scope as narrow, as specific as possible. This is the first point. Second point with regard to the retrospective assessment, I have sympathy with those companies. If those companies are applying IS 39, and the ineffectiveness arising from the uncertainty of the ABOR reform, I think we should provide the same relief as the prospective assessment we're giving them. But the problem is how to make sure those ineffectiveness really arriving from, you know, those uncertainty of the IBOR reform. So I prefer maybe we should ask them to provide some additional disclosure. Maybe we should ask them to, as paragraph 14B said, that we should require them to demonstrate whether the economic regime still exists or not. In this case, actually, the principle similar to IFRS 9. So, yeah. To reduce some additional risk here.
There are two other quick questions, and this is a little bit of a shotgun approach now because it's all the sort of remaining ones very quickly. I just want to confirm paragraph 6 of the B paper. is the one that lists the three issues. Of those three issues, I-39 we've spoken about a lot, the reassessment, and that's part of this phase. Modifications and derecognition is part of the next phase. Hedge documentation, next phase. Okay, so that's confirmed, that one. And then the other one I wanted to quickly ask is a little bit of what I thought Jen Chao was actually going to go with. The phasing of the FASB's projects is not entirely aligned with the phasing of our projects. They've been going through a slightly different process and in different orders. But I did wonder whether there is anything in the feedback they have received or that they're getting that we need to think about in terms of the process we're going through, particularly for phase one. And whether there is anything out there that staff have become aware of that we should know about. And perhaps what I'm looking for is whether they've had any different feedback on any of these topics relative to what we've heard.
Not on the issues we've covered in phase one, because with the way they've dealt with what is a separately identifiable benchmark, they don't really have the issue that we are having with LIBOR at the moment. But with regards to the issues that they are looking at now and that they will include in their upcoming exposure draft, those are the same issues that we will be looking in the next phase of the project. And so we are talking to them quite regularly to check, you know, how their thinking is developing, sharing how we are thinking about things and the way we are maybe thinking of putting a solution together for those issues. So we are looking at the same issues. We are trying to understand how they get to where they are on their decisions and how we can as closely as possible align if possible, but because our standards are slightly different, might not always be the case.
Nick?
I think we just need to be clear on what our current intentions are, because there's been a little bit of chat about phase 1B. At the moment, it's my understanding it's a phase 1 to deal with pre-replacement issues and then a phase 2 to deal with replacement issues, and that is our intention as things stand today. Yes.
Okay. Oh, Mary?
There are just two more things. One, picking up on Daryl's comment about FASB, I'll just say this is anecdotal, but chatting after the meeting with one of the FASB members, that member made the comment that we are facing much bigger issues in terms of IBOR because they are focused solely on the SOFR. You know, so they're very focused on the U.S. regulatory context and a single rate change that's being managed in a single jurisdiction. And so they could focus much more narrowly on a specific set of mechanics and not have to build something that could work in a number of different environments. So that is to say it's not relevant, but that is another consideration that differentiates what they're doing from this project, even though they're driven by the same global regulatory reform. The other is, in a number of places, there have been requests for more guidance, more examples, et cetera. One thing that struck me is I don't want the future, especially of I4S9, to be encumbered by a history of a lot of examples that get integrated in respect of a single issue, and then the question becomes, do we take them out after we're done, or do they sit there and give people ideas of other purposes for which they could be, you know, reused, et cetera. So if we decide that some further examples are needed, maybe we should think about publishing some accompanying educational material at the same time that we do this that doesn't get incorporated in the standard the same way, that examples of the types that people are suggesting. If what people are after is accessible, helpful illustrations, I'm not saying we should do that. I'm just saying I think we should think more broadly than we might if we were doing kind of a normal longer term, project with a longer life.
Okay. I don't necessarily disagree with what Mary just said, because it's a little bit odd that we are going to have these paragraphs which we think are going to have a pretty short life in the context of a standard which I'm hoping is going to be around for a long time. Talking about IFRS 9, just
for avoidance of doubt.
But I think people did raise a number of fair points about the balance between the amount we put at the front of the document and the amount we put in the basis. Mm-hmm. And I think we do need to be careful to make sure that we've got enough of the stuff you need to understand to apply what we're saying at the front of the document.
Yeah.
Mary, on your first point, man, I don't understand that, because, man, if U.S. company using U.S. GAAP has a subsidiary here in Europe. They have to deal also with this kind of reform. I think that is maybe...
I'm telling you what I was told rather than I said that...
Okay, but maybe there's...
Well, I was told that they were focused really only on SOFR.
Okay.
That's where the literature gets from.
That's where the literature gets from. Yeah. So just to sort of summarize everything and talk a bit about the August meeting and how we're going to distinguish these items. As I think Mary already mentioned, that some of these items seems to fall into phase one more and some of them fall into phase two. So for the August meeting, we plan to bring you papers that will cover the retrospective effectiveness testing, the application of the separately identifiable criteria to portfolio fair value hedges, the disclosure point, and looking at whether we can maybe reduce the amount of quantitative disclosures that people need to give, and also maybe just a clarification of how the end of relief would apply in certain circumstances and whether it really applies to both the hedged item and the hedging instrument or to each individual on its own, and also how that works in a sort of like a macro cash flow hedge where things might change at different times and some of the loans might move to a new rate and some of them might not, and how that would work. So that, but all of these were just apart from the retrospective, but the others are just clarifications, I think, of what we intentionally or originally meant with those. The reason we are not bringing anything on modifications or the changes in hedge documentation and what happens at the end of relief is that I think all of these are interrelated. You have to answer the first question around modifications first before you can say what happens with the change in hedge documentation, before you can say how you need to treat the end of relief. So I think all of those goes together as a package. And, you know, to the point that we need to get phase one done and out of the way, and in the meantime we'll continue the analysis and the work on phase two and bring those issues to you at a future board meeting for discussion. And then also at the August meeting, if everything goes well, we plan to ask for your permission to start the balloting process on the phase one finalizations so that we can get that process going at the same time.
Okay. Thank you very much. So, the final topic of this week is dynamic risk management. I'll give the floor to Russ.
I'll just start off.
Okay.
Shall I? Okay.